Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 258 for July 12th, 2013. Greetings from downtown Denver, Colorado, where I am putting this episode together earlier than usual on Wednesday morning. That's because Darlene, the Yorkie Claire, and I will be heading out on the highway tomorrow, Thursday, for points east on our 11-day drive to Cambridge, Massachusetts. So by the time this hits the internets on Friday morning, we will probably be leaving Grand Island, Nebraska, for 3 nights in Omaha to visit Darlene's sister, Deb. Now, Deb doesn't know it yet. Please don't tell her if you see her. I am going to be bringing a brand new Kindle Paperwhite for her that I won at a drawing at the Amazon booth at Book Expo America. I think she's ready to graduate from the Kindle keyboard, and I'm hoping that she will gift the keyboard to ebooksfortroops.org once she gets used to the Paperwhite. From Omaha, we are going to continue on making overnight stops in Davenport, Iowa, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario, Toronto, Kingston, Ontario, and Albany, New York, and then on into Cambridge. I uploaded next week's show, TKC 259, yesterday in advance so that I will be able to focus on the 11-day drive without the usual Thursday-Friday project of the weekly show next week. Darlene and I will have our Kindles loaded with good reading material, of course, and I'm going to have David Schnark's Passionate Marriage queued up on my Kindle Fire so we can listen to it from time to time in manageable doses via the text-to-speech computerized lady's voice, connected to the Ford Focus's audio system with an audio cable connected to the headphone port on the Kindle Fire. It's easier than it sounds. While we are in Cambridge and Maine until the end of the year, I will be connected to a new source of ebooks at the Douglas County Libraries, located south of Denver here in Colorado. And that's going to give me a chance to follow the nationally pioneering work that the director of the libraries, Jamie LaRue, has been doing to help libraries across the country take their destinies in hand as they face a high-stakes game of chicken with the Big Six, now Big Five, publishers. Jamie is my guest for this week's interview.
Right now, that's the big problem with the Big Six is they lease it to us, but they don't sell it to us, and they're charging in some cases as much as 8-9 times as much as the consumer cost.
I was all set to record this morning when I saw news that Judge Denise Coate has ruled today against Apple in the price-fixing ebook lawsuit. There's also a dramatic development in the Barnes & Noble story, a new Amazon imprint for comics, and a Hot Boy Genius report on 3 new Kindle Fire models coming this fall. That's all in news. For the tech tip, I will tell you how I helped solve a listener's Kindle DX problem, and will report on a change that makes it harder to manage a Kindle collection of books shared by several people using an Amazon account. And in content, I'm going to sing the praises of a free reader app named Bluefire that has enabled me to use my Kindle Fire HD 7-inch to read ebooks purchased directly from small publishers by Douglas County Libraries. They also have all the Overdrive books, which are easy to read on a Kindle Fire and on an e-ink Kindle. But those ones that they're experimenting with, you need Bluefire or something like it to read, and I'll tell you how to do that. As I said, I was just about to sit down at the microphone with a nice, tidy script, and there was the news that Judge Denise Coate ruled against Apple. So I'll give you some of the highlights here and then links to it in the show notes, including a link to the PDF with the 160-plus page decision. She's a crisp, strong writer, and she really just dismantles the Apple case at every point. And on the final page, it says, in the end, it is essential to remember that the antitrust laws were enacted for, quote, the protection of competition, not competitors. That's from Brown Shoe Company versus U.S., et cetera. The question in this case, she continued, has always been a narrow one, whether Apple participated in a price-fixing scheme in violation of this country's antitrust laws. Apple is liable here for facilitating and encouraging the publisher defendants' collective illegal restraint of trade. Through their conspiracy, they forced Amazon and other resellers to relinquish retail price authority, and then they raised retail ebook prices. Those higher prices were not the result of regular market forces, but of a scheme in which Apple was a full participant. Andrew Albanese, I heard from him by email just a few minutes ago, and he is working already on an update to his ebook that we talked about last week, The Battle for $9.99, and I'm sure that'll be an excellent analysis of the verdict. He said we'll be working on it today and tomorrow, hopefully by Monday. And he says, I can let you know for sure after I'm done with the news. Of course, he's covering the news this morning, and his article is just up at Publishers Weekly, and I'll have a link to that. In his email to me, I think it's okay to include this. It's pretty much tracks his coverage. Decision is a total bloodbath. Apple got spanked on every argument. It's also pretty amazing that this decision is out 2 weeks after the conclusion of the trial. Judge Cote has been up late typing on her MacBook Air, maybe, and preparing a really definitive decision against Apple. Apple says they're going to appeal, and the next step, I guess, is to that appeal runs its course, and then there'll be a separate hearing before Judge Cote on the amount of money that Apple will have to pay, which will make its way to those of us who have purchased ebooks at inflated prices. Probably not anytime soon as this plays out, and Apple certainly doesn't have any incentive to move quickly through the appeals part of it. Big news, and I'm glad it happened just in time for me to get it in for this show, even though I'm putting it together earlier in the week than usual. There was other big news this week. The Barnes & Noble CEO, who did such a valiant job trying to turn a traditional bookseller into a serious ebook and e-reader competitor to Amazon, is going to resign. The company's board of director announced on Monday. I don't think anyone saw this coming, despite the bad earnings reports for the Nook business that have been coming out all year. The new CEO will be Michael P. Huseby, H-U-S-E-B-Y. He's the current chief financial officer. Slate, the online magazine, slapped a weirdly sarcastic headline on the story, which read, "A new CEO will totally turn around Barnes & Noble's technologically obsolete business and dying industry." The article is written by Matthew Iglesias, and he gives William Lynch, the outgoing CEO, credit for pulling off something which he calls nearly impossible. Quote, "A brick-and-mortar retail chain reinvented itself on the fly as a manufacturer of hardware computing devices, and in the Nook created a device that everyone agrees is pretty good. But pretty good isn't good enough to be commercially viable in a world of big platform players like Amazon, Apple, and Samsung. Now it looks like the Nook business is curdling, and so Lynch is going down with the ship. But really, he and his team have done a great job in a nearly impossible situation." Iglesias took appropriate note of the irony of the Barnes & Noble saga in this final sentence of his post. "One day you're the soulless corporate behemoth, crushing independent bookstores beneath your mighty boot and doing a damn fine job of it, and the next thing you know, the prevailing technological winds shift and you're roadkill." Exactly. Also in news, Amazon Publishing has created Jet City Comics, a new publishing imprint, and it's focused on comics and graphic novels. It launches with new comics from George R.R. Martin, Hugh Howey, the author of Wool, who seems to be everywhere these days, and Neal Stephenson. The one that's available now is Symposium Number 9, the first original four-world comic from a series created by Stephenson, Greg Bear, Mark Teppo, and others. It's available for 99 cents. You know, I looked at it, I didn't think the drawings were that great. I'm no expert on this type of reading, but it may be a good story, but the drawings seemed fairly crude compared to what I'm used to, which is the Superman comics. Original adaptations of Martin's short story Meat House Man and Howie's Wool are set to follow in October. Amazon said Jet City will publish on Kindle as standalone comics, as serialized comics over multiple episodes, and as bundled graphic novels. And also they're going to make print editions available at Amazon.com and other comics retailers, probably, I would guess, not Barnes & Noble. And finally in news, we've got the opening salvos from this year's rumor season for the next new Kindles. This item from Boy Genius quotes unnamed sources at Amazon foretelling three new Kindle Fire devices, all with better resolution, thinner dimensions, and more attractive design at maybe somewhere near the existing prices for the Kindle Fire second generation 7-inch, the Kindle Fire HD 7-inch, and the Fire HD 8.9-inch. No word in this report about what we might be looking at for new e-ink Kindles. Last year's press release in Santa Monica took place on September 6th, so I wouldn't be surprised if that's about the time we can expect the next generation of devices and services. I'll have a link in the show notes so that you can check it out. Time now for some tech tips. I heard from a listener, Jackie, who had a problem with her DX. I'm always glad to hear somebody still using the DX. There's just something about that big e-ink Kindle that was always appealing to me. I've sold mine since I've switched to tablets. But Jackie was having some trouble. She was wanting to update the software on her DX, and when she connected the DX to her computer with a USB cable, it wasn't showing up on the computer. It didn't recognize it. So I suggested restarting it and restarting the computer, but then the other idea that I passed along that ended up working was to simply try a different USB cable. So that's something that if you've got this sort of a problem mounting your Kindle so that you can do things with it related to your computer and it's not showing up, just try a different USB cable with that same micro or mini USB connection that fits into the Kindle. And sometimes different cables have different abilities to work. So I'm glad that one worked out. I also had a question from Doris, and she said, I have several people on my account, and I used to be able to see who bought a book by clicking on pending deliveries, and from there on to recent successful deliveries. So she could see which of her friends or family had downloaded specific books, and I could see how that would be useful. Have you found any way to get that information? Now, I don't share books on my accounts. Darlene does with a lot of her friends and family, and but she doesn't do that kind of technical stuff that Doris was doing to keep track of it. But I know somebody who is in tune with this, has got quite an elaborate family sharing system, and that's Pastor Mark Pierce at Church Requil in Mansfield, Ohio. So I reached out to Mark to see if he had any workaround on this, and he replied, sorry, I've run into the same problem. I don't know why Amazon no longer provides this information, and I haven't been able to find it anywhere else. So that's too bad that that way to track information on sharing is apparently just no longer available. For the Kindle Fire, I came across, didn't realize that there's been a Kindle Fire experimental flash video player that shows up on a number of sites. I found it at NBC.com watching a Jay Leno video, and normally you'd get a message saying, sorry, you can't play this video in the Silk browser. That's why I downloaded a browser named Dolphin that enabled me to do it. But now Amazon has this message that shows up saying that you can try the experimental flash video player. And on this site, it worked great. It was very smooth. And I think they're using some of the Silk capabilities of things that are in the cloud versus on your computer. But it's good news that if they roll this out further, there won't be those videos when you're browsing on your Kindle Fire that you can't see because they run on flash. George from Tulsa sent me a warning from my tech tip about using the Good e-reader site to download Kobo. He said, I clicked out to see what there is for the Fire HD. I was disappointed. It was apparently installed Google Apps, but they didn't work. So when he was downloading apps from that site, they weren't working. And then he adds, the heads up is the browser app for Firefox is old. That's a potential security hole. Don't know if all the apps are stale, but it is a concern. So that thing seemed to work okay for Kobo, but maybe the Good e-reader site is not the best place to get apps onto your Fire that aren't available in the Kindle store. Jamie LaRue is director of the Douglas County Libraries, where he's worked since 1990, way before the first rumblings of the ebook revolution that would upend the world of publishing as well as the world of public libraries. The Douglas County Libraries, located south of Denver, have 7 physical branches, and you're going to get a feel for the bucolic nature of this area between Denver and Colorado Springs when you hear the names of the locations of those branches. They are Castle Rock, Parker, Lone Tree, Highlands Ranch, Louvier, Roxborough, and Castle Pines. You'll get a feel for how up-to-date this library system is by listening to an excerpt from a video that's on their site describing what they call the eighth branch of the libraries. That's the digital branch. The first voice you'll hear is that of Jamie LaRue.
Admit it, you've wondered whether or not we still need public libraries in the 21st century, in the age of the internet, in the age of the e-book reader. The answer, of course, is yes. Welcome to the Douglas County Libraries, the library of tomorrow. I think in the 19th and 20th century, the purpose of the library was to bring the world to the community. And I think where we are now is we're taking the community to the world.
Our reality has totally changed here.
The demand for e-content is enormous.
I've never seen things change so quickly in the library world.
We're just trying to make the experience and access better for our patrons.
A tremendous percentage of the books that we check out get checked out because they're on display. How do you display an ebook?
We've had power walls in our libraries for a number of years.
It's the whole idea of interactivity.
When you walk into the building, you would see this screen, envision a wall-sized iPad, a touch screen that shows you the title as it scrolls past.
These displays are accessible from your computer, from your home, from mobile apps, as well as large touch screen apps within our libraries.
It's fun.
People are going to be drawn to it.
You just want to touch it and see what's going to happen.
We really think that that's the future of how you would want to browse the virtual collection.
We're blazing a path here with e-content.
Changing the way libraries see themselves.
More and more libraries will say, this is what we need to be doing for our patrons.
Innovative, creative.
One-stop shopping.
Douglas County Libraries.
Accessible.
Convenient.
The future is now.
To learn more about that future, I spoke with Jamie LaRue by Skype on Monday, July 8th, reaching him at his office in Castle Rock, Colorado. I began by asking him to elaborate on a statement that I had seen him make in another interview, namely that this is the most exciting time in the history of mankind to be a librarian.
This is a time of creative destruction. So as I think back in the past, there's only been a couple of times in human history when we've seen this kind of sweeping technological change that then ushers in a host of cultural changes. First one would be Gutenberg and this tremendous explosion of print that happened after that that invention. And the second would probably be the broadside movement from around the time of the American Revolution. So somebody would be writing something wild, they would take it to a local newspaper editor, and they would crank out all these copies. Well, in the past probably 4 or 5 years, we've seen a 3 or 4-fold increase in the total volume of intellectual content. How could that not be exciting? And so what it does is it completely changes our relationship with publishers and distributors and reviewers and every link in that chain of the publishing ecosystem.
You've talked about hardback books going the way of illuminated manuscripts. Is that something that you see being accomplished in the next 5 years, the next 20 years, 50 years? Where do you think we are on the continuum of history in actually the way the technology changes?
Well, you know, the former Librarian of Congress, Daniel Burstyn, used to write about something called the displacement fallacy. And the idea here is that every new format replaces the old one. And as we know, that isn't really true. So if you take a look, television did not kill radio. Radio is still around. And I think that there are many, many people in the United States that don't have access to e-book readers or the internet. And for those people, the book continues to be a very cost-effective and powerful way to get the word out, whether it's a story or nonfiction. So I think that we're not going to see the complete disappearance of print or hardback. But I think it's fair to say that there will at least be multiple formats. It would not surprise me to find out that 50% of the content produced by publishers by the end of the year will be electronic as well. Now, that also provides quite a challenge to libraries because right now we buy something in hardback, we buy it as large print, we might buy it in paperback, we buy it as an audiobook, we buy it as a playaway, and now we're also expected to buy it as an ebook. So there's right now, in the short run, there's quite a challenge for libraries to keep up with all the different formats that are available.
Now, and there's been a particular challenge with the Big Six publishers from the point of view of libraries, and that led to your creation of what's being called the Douglas County Libraries e-book model. How does that work?
Okay, well, I'll talk about it from two sides. From the purchasing side, what we do is we reach out to various publishers and we say, here's how we do business. We would like to buy and own a copy of your file. We would like to get a discount for it. We will attach digital rights management to it by default using kind of industry standard approaches. We will restrict its use to one person at a time. If people are waiting for it, if we have four people waiting, we buy another copy. So we purchase additional copies to meet demand. And we will also provide a link to purchase it. So if a patron looks at it in our catalog and says, oh, gee, it's checked out, I'll put it on hold, they can also say, I would prefer to buy it. And if they buy it, then we would like a percentage of that sale. So that's kind of the general agreement with the publisher, and it is significantly different from the Big Six in that A, we own the file, B, we get a discount for it. And right now, that's the big problem with the Big Six is they lease it to us, but they don't sell it to us, and they're charging in some cases as much as 8-9 times as much as the consumer cost. And the third big problem that our approach solves that the Big Six problem reveals is that right now we can't integrate Big Six content very easily into our catalogs because we don't have access to the file. But if we own it, then you can do one search and find everything that we own. So it's much simpler to integrate that content if we own it.
It seems as if the traditional compact between the publishers, I suppose, of all sizes and libraries for the past 100 years was based on the idea that they thought they were going to get a benefit if they gave you favorable terms buying books because it increased reading. Is it the case that they just are questioning whether that's true when book reading shifts digital?
Well, I think that there are two factors here. One of them is under the original first sale doctrine, which applies to print, even if a publisher says we don't want to sell it to libraries, well, somebody else could buy it and they could sell it to us because once you own it, you can sell it. But the rules around ebooks are more like software. And so if they say we don't want to sell it to libraries just to see if we make more money, just to see if maybe library borrowing does cannibalize our sales, so let's just not sell to them. Because it's software, because it can be leased, I can't buy it from someone else. So they had the historic opportunity to cut us out of the market, and they took it. And the second aspect is that, you know, do libraries, in fact, result in greater sales? And I think that both anecdotally and based on research, the answer is yes. I know myself, the way I got into buying books as a young man, I would go to book sales, I would find very cheap books, I would find authors that I loved, and I would start to buy them. And then you kind of develop this book buying habit. And so I have no doubt that finding cheap books and borrowing books encourage me to read more because nobody can afford to buy all the books that they want to read. And then the second thing is about on the basis of research. There have been two big studies now. One was done by Bowker and Library Journal. They teamed up to do a study. And one was done by Pew, P-E-W. And then a third one was done by the Douglas County Libraries. And we just asked this question. Do you read ebooks? Do you borrow ebooks from the library? And for those people who said yes, we said, and how does that affect your purchasing? And what we've learned is that if you're a power user, somebody who uses the library once a week or more, you buy, on average, one ebook for every two that you borrow. Hmm. And typically the one that you buy is the one that you borrowed. Hmm. So people are using the library to discover things, to figure out if it's worth the money, and then they're buying the one that we help them find.
It's almost as if it's a longer sample than you can get at Amazon, because you can basically look at the whole book, but the limit is 21 days. And I know a lot of times 21 days is enough for me to finish a book, so yeah. I'm a prime candidate to buy it at that point.
Right. Well, you know, and I feel like in some ways, like if you borrow a physical item and it's the loan period is the same for a short book or a long book, and you borrow Anna Karenina and you don't get through it in 3 weeks, well, right now you can just keep the item and pay a fine when you bring it back. And with the ebook, it's gone. It's gone from your device after 3 weeks. So that's probably a use barrier that we should figure out a way to solve rather than say, you know, it encourages sales.
How successful have you been signing up publishers under the terms that you're, I won't say dictating, but you're certainly being clear on what kinds of terms you're interested in? How many people have responded?
Well, let me back up and make another comment about those terms. When we first tried to directly contact some publishers to say we want to buy your ebooks, they said, okay, great, we'll send you a contract. And so we got the contract, changed a few things we didn't like, sent it back. They changed a few things, sent it back. This went back and forth till suddenly we'd spent almost $3,000 on attorney's fees. And so then I called back this first publisher and I said, look, you don't want to spend money on attorneys. We don't want to spend money on attorneys. We can't afford to monitor different contracts with every publisher. Suppose we just agree that here's how we want to do business. And so we put together this common understanding that's just, you know, if you agree with these terms and sell to us, and you know, that's, we'll just agree that that's how we do business. So when we first started calling people, we weren't sure how successful we'd be. We didn't know if they would be open to this or not, because the Big Six were so adamant that they didn't want those terms. And what we found is that now we have over 900 publishers who have said yes.
Wow. How many titles does that translate to?
That's translated to us for about 22,000 titles that we've purchased so far. You know, so we still have about 14,000 things that we're buying, quote, meaning renting, from 3M and Overdrive and the people that are, you know, restricting our access. But we're really finding that outside of the Big Six, most publishers are more than happy to sell to libraries. They believe and they see the advantage of making their books discoverable through us.
The DRM part seems, I mean, it's problematic in publishing, and you see some changes coming, like Tor publishing its books without DRM. I have a Kindle, so I can't access the titles that you've got in the Douglas County archive because it doesn't read EPUB, and they're all EPUB. That's how you're doing the DRM, I assume, through, is it all through Adobe?
That's correct. So there are a couple comments about that. When we first tried to figure out how to get into this game where we could manage our own e-content, publishers were saying there was really only one platform that they trusted, and that was the Adobe Content Server. So we bought one. And we said, okay, if that's the industry standard, we'll follow it. When we tried to work with Amazon, because for a long time, Kindle was the primary e-reader in America, now it's fallen to less than half. And the,
you think it's less than half in terms of e-books? I see more like 60%.
In terms of e-readers,
e-readers
that are now being sold, the Kindle has fallen to less than half. And then if you look at the dedicated e-reader like pre-Kindle Fire, those are falling very rapidly. So people seem to be preferring the tablet form to that. Well, the good news about that is that under the old Kindle, that Mobi file format with the DRM attached to it is something that Amazon doesn't share with anybody. We can't provide that format because Amazon controls it. So they've completely locked us out of that market.
The DRM version of it. You can do a Mobi file, just you can't do the DRM.
Right, but if I stop doing DRM, then what's to stop somebody from stealing it from us, just getting it one copy and then making it available to people? So libraries are really trying to support author copyright on this one. We do not want to be seen as a channel for people to steal things from writers. So we went with Adobe Content with this. But as I say, the trend is that the old dedicated e-reader is going away. The tablet is coming out, and that means we can write an app that enables a Kindle to check out an EPUB. So I think that the problem will go away over the space of the next couple of years.
As people move more to the tablet, so you would be writing an app that could run on a Kindle Fire?
Yes, and we have already done so.
How do you think the merger of Penguin and Random House, which is just completed, does that have any kind of a major effect on how easy the Big Six are going to be to get along with?
Well, I think what you're seeing here is the further consolidation of the market. You know, so you have Big Six publishers now down to Big Five and falling, I think. And so this is a market response to this incredible explosion of small, independent, and self-published titles coming up on the other side. So I think what we're seeing is kind of what we saw with the music industry. You have a few big players trying to squeeze their hands together and hold on to this market. And one of the ways they're doing that is by jacking up the price. I think it's a mistake. You know, so both Penguin and Random House charge more than they charge consumers. They charge libraries more for the book. And so what that means is we can't buy as many copies of the ebook as we can buy of print. And so since our patrons are asking us for more ebooks, that means we have to turn to other suppliers, other sources of materials. So I think that what this does is it hastens the decline of big publishers by pricing themselves out of the library market.
You have gained some success in interesting other library systems in this model. I saw that Massachusetts, have they signed up yet, the consortium in Massachusetts?
No, they did the RFP and they got four responses to it. Now they're negotiating to whittle it down from there. So yes, we're seeing some real pickup. Khalifa has something like 228 libraries around the state and they've adopted our model. We have some folks in Florida that are interested in it, a Tampa Bay Library Consortium, and a couple in big library consortiums in Texas around Dallas and Houston, and then we've got one in North Carolina. So a lot of people are experimenting with it.
Now, in each place where they try the model, do they have to pay $200,000 to buy the Adobe platform and set it up for themselves?
No, the Adobe platform doesn't cost that much. It's a $10,000 purchase.
Oh, okay.
One-time purchase.
And once you've bought that, you can apply the DRM to your titles and control all of that.
So the additional cost, like referring to that $200,000 cost, so we spent in our first year $10,000 to buy the Adobe Content Server, and we spent about another $90,000 on original software development on a program called ViewFind. ViewFind is an open source discovery tool that's been out there for a while. So all of the changes we made to it were to enable ViewFind to integrate with the Adobe Content Server and our catalog and to be able to deliver that content as well. So once we finished that, we put it up on a website and we said to any library in the world, you may download this software for free, because we think it's in our advantage for other libraries to adopt it.
One interesting aspect of what you're doing is the idea that you can support local authors through self-publishing services and things like that. That gave me a warm feeling, but then I thought, well, if I'm a local author in Castle Rock, I really want a national market. I'm not going to depend on the people that use the Castle Rock Library as my main audience. I won't be able to make a living doing that way. So why aren't I better off just going to Kindle Direct Publishing and CreateSpace and the other sort of national tools out there to help me publish my book, as opposed to the services that you might be able to offer there at the library?
Well, I don't think it's one or the other. There's no reason why you can't do both. But I think the real issue is this. A recent study done by Pew asked people, how many of you think you want to write a book? And they found that 85% of the human race thinks they could and should. But the question is whether or not they can write a good one. And that is, I think, the role of the public library. So I describe it this way. Imagine that there is a banner on the front page of the library website, which has more than 2 million visits a year. So we get a lot of traffic. And suppose it says you want to write a book, and you click on it, it says, do you want to write a good one? Because that's different. And if you're serious about that, here's a list of all of our resources at the library that will help you write a good book. Here's a list of the writer organizations within the metropolitan areas between Denver and Colorado Springs that you could team up with, because at some point you're going to want critical feedback. Here's a list of all the editors, because if you want your book to be any good at all, you have to pay to have it professionally edited. Mm-hmm. You want it to have a cover? Here's a list of people that will do that. So I see this new role of libraries is not just marketing. It's helping you write a good book. Mm-hmm. But once we do that, I think we can expose your writing in a way that Amazon, you know, has difficulty. If you go to Amazon and you're a local author, how is somebody going to find you? You know, yes, it has a great distribution network, but the issue is, in the 21st century, with this explosion of writing from 300,000 titles a year to close to 1 million a year, how does anybody stumble across your work? And at the local public library, we can feature local authors. We can do digital displays. We can do a channel on a mobile application that says, are you interested in what your local community is writing? And I think that way we can begin to give you some exposure, begin to give you some feedback. We can give you a prize at the end of the year that says our best local author, give you some cash dollars to purchase an interview or a review in Publishers Weekly, and we can help you get discovered.
Hmm. Now, how far down the road of that vision are you?
I would say about 50%. So we've written the job description for local community acquisition people and reviewers. And we've reached out a little bit to some of the local author communities to say, if we help you write the book, will you donate a copy to us? And do you understand that if we funnel your first chapter and an outline of your book to a local collection advisor, and they say, you know, this hasn't been edited, or it's pornographic, or, you know, looks like it's stolen, and we turn you down, do you understand that that's a decision on the part of the library, that we're looking for quality material? So I'm hoping to have this up and running by the end of the year.
Do you have a title in view yet that might be your first breakout hit?
No, but we've gotten some pretty interesting submissions. You know about NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month? Mm-hmm. We did a competition there where we had a teen winner, and we said, your prize is now we'll take your manuscript that you generated in that month of writing, and we'll pay to have it professionally edited, and then we'll add it to our collection. So keep watching us. I hope to discover one or two geniuses in the local in our backyard.
Well, now, I'm picturing a county government, Douglas County. It has a library system and it has you as the director, going to national conferences, being kind of an evangelist for a very creative, whole new look at what libraries should be doing in the digital age. What benefit does Douglas County get of you becoming a kind of a national figure leading this movement? Does it bring any revenue back to the county in some of these activities, or just the good news that some important work is happening right there locally?
Well, I guess I'll say three things. One, we're not actually a county department. We are an independent library district.
Okay.
We happen to have the same boundaries as the county. Mm-hmm. The second thing is our library board, which is very forward-thinking, they looked at it like this. We have a problem, a business problem, that if we can't buy the content that's being produced, if we're being priced out of the market, that affects our long-term relevancy. The public looks to us for access to the content. If we can't have it, it's a problem. One library by itself can't apply enough economic pressure to some of these publishers, so we need partners. We have to find other libraries that will jump on board with us to encourage other publishers to adopt the model, to lower their prices, to sell to us. So it's very much in the best interest of the Douglas County Libraries that I go out and try to sell this model. The more people who sign up, the more publishers we have on board, the more secure our future will be. But the third aspect of this is that I've been here for 20 years. I have a lot of vacation time. And so when I go off to evangelize to various places around the country, I usually take time off.
That's fascinating. I have been speaking with Jamie LaRue, director of the Douglas County Libraries in Colorado. Thanks very much, Jamie.
Thank you, Lon.
I want to follow up and mention a tool that has enabled me to access the books at the Douglas County Libraries that they're purchasing directly from publishers, which Jamie talked about in the interview. It's called Blue Fire Reader, and if you have it on your Kindle Fire, then you'll be able to enter an Adobe username and password. You have to sign up with Adobe because this is how they protect the copyright and the digital rights management on these books. But once you've done that, you can download books to your Kindle Fire, and they open fairly easily through Blue Fire Reader. There are other readers like this, but this is one that I think is very solid. I've heard about it from Joshua Talent and the eBook Ninjas, so I trust it as a good tool, and it's nicely designed. One thing that's handy is that you can download it without using Good eReader or GetJar or any of these other areas that have made it possible to download apps that you can't find at the Amazon store. This one, if you go to a website on your browser on the Fire and you enter a URL, I'll have this on the show notes, but if you want to play with it now, it's not that difficult a one to remember. It's bluefirereader.com, and Blue Fire Reader is all one word, lowercase, .com/files, F-I-L-E-S, slash, and then capital B for Blue Fire, and then capital R for reader, .apk. And if you click on that from your browser, it's automatically going to download the Blue Fire Reader to your Fire, and then you'll find the downloaded app by pulling down the Quick Settings menu from the top of your screen. You'll see the downloaded .apk file under Notifications, and then if you tap on it and follow the prompts, you'll be able to install it and open it. You can also get Blue Fire Reader for an iPad or an iPhone and any other Android tablet. So the way this works, if you live in Colorado, by the way, you can get to the Douglas County Library online, and they'll give you a digital card that's good for 30 days, but within that time you do have to go in person to confirm your identity and make the card permanent. Jamie saved me a trip because he was sure that I was who I said I was, and so I will have that card going forward when I'm in Massachusetts for the rest of the year, and I'll be able to check in and see what sorts of content he's getting in this very pioneering effort to take control of his fate at the library and to help other libraries to do the same thing. Also in content, I want to pass along a tip from a UK listener, Mark Jarvis, who emailed me a link to a rave review in The Guardian of a book titled The Old Ways by Robert McFarland, M-A-C-F-A-R-L-A-N-D. The book is the final one in a trilogy about landscape and the human heart, and it focuses on walks on land and routes traveled over the sea. I've added the book to my wish list, and I'll include a link to it and to the review in the show notes. That looks like a good tip. I've got a little bit of a controversy going in comments. I had someone make a critical comment of Stephen King because the Joyland is not available on Kindle. And in response to that, Karen Horvath wrote that she made a reference to the kind of people who scan and share generally aren't the people who pay for it. And so my anonymous poster before replied, "Oh boy, I have bought 400 or so books from Amazon. About 350 of those I could have pirated if I'd wanted to. It's that easy. But I feel the majority of people just want to be able to buy digital content however and whenever they want and consume it on whatever device and form factor they choose." Karen said King released a paperback as a retro celebration? Okay, then why not release a book about the Middle Ages on animal vellum only? Steve Jobs proved with iTunes that people will pay for content that is delivered quick and easy for them, and Amazon has proved it too. I can't read on paper anymore. I get a headache and my OCD starts pinging. So that was, and he signs a deep throat, so he's maintaining his anonymity. These kinds of issues about what's available in ebooks and what isn't, especially when you get an author as popular as Stephen King, create some controversy, which it's good to have a little controversy on the show. So Karen, back to you if you'd like to comment on Deep Throat's rebuttal there. I'll say I've watched the second episode of Stephen King's Under the Dome, which is available for free at Prime Instant Video, and it's pretty amazing. It's it looks kind of how I thought it would look when I read the book originally on my Kindle. I want to thank those of you who are supporting the podcast by making contributions, clicking on the Amazon ad at thekindlechronicles.com, which generates commissions for me under Amazon Associates without increasing what you pay. I'd also like to direct your attention to the bookgorilla.com icon that I've got on the page. It's kind of a cool one with a book coming out of a banana peel. This is Stephen Windwalker's initiative, which if you sign up for it, by clicking on that icon and then you stick with it, there'll be a commission for the podcast as well from doing that. And it's a great list. I get it every day, and the other day I purchased two books, one by Dorothy L. Sayers and one by Leon Uris, Topaz. I can't remember the prices, but you know they're under $3, so they alert bargains to you, and you pick the categories that you want to be alerted to, and so it's all very handy and nicely done. And if you want to check it out and you click on that link on the show notes, that's another way to help out. Next week's show, as I said, I've already done it, and it's three interviews that I have held over from my trip to BEA in New York, and then also a fascinating panel about self-publishing at BEA that I didn't attend myself, but James McQuivy is on it, and that worked out well. For the five-year anniversary show, which we'll work on when I get back to Cambridge, I've got a special guest. I'm not going to get your hopes too high. It's not the special guest I had last year, but it's one that I'm going to enjoy visiting with if it all works out, and I'll be putting together an interview in person on my trip so that I'll have that for you for TKC 260, the fifth anniversary show of the Kindle Chronicles. Music for my podcast is from an original Thelonious Monk composition named Well You Needn't. This version is Ramonk by Eval Monegat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD by Public Transit Recording. This is Len Edgerly in Denver, Colorado for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.